leave the scouts with insufficient time to fish. This problem was made much worse because of a long-standing tradition in the colony that birds shared their food with their children, and only with their children. No adults caught fish for other adults. It simply was not done. The effect of the good news at first outweighed the bad, but then No-No's antics, anxious children, anxiety among the parents of anxious children, infighting in the leadership council, and the feeding the scouts problem began to take their toll. No-No and a few of his friends saw the obstacles and were encouraged. Maybe if they worked a little harder. Amanda was one of the most enthusiastic and hardworking of the birds in the group of planners. She believed in the vision of a new way of life. She worked 14-hour days to help make it a reality. But then her husband, unnerved by No-No's pronouncements, demanded that she stop. Long, difficult conversations ensued. Then her child's nightmares became so chilling that she found herself spending half the night tending to the little bird. When she heard about the feeding the scouts problem, her level of frustration outgrew her initial excitement. Feeling powerless to deal with forces beyond her control, she started to skip the planning meetings. And she was not alone. By Thursday that week, three other birds were also missing the meetings. By Friday, that number had grown to 8. By Saturday, to 15. The bird chairing those planning meetings tried to stop the outflow of membership with a clear restatement of the facts. Iceberg melting. Must change. Have a good vision. Time for implementation. The logic was impeccable, and it had no effect on the dropping attendance. Alice saw that many of the more enthusiastic birds were becoming very frustrated by the mounting obstacles. "We have to deal with this," she told Lewis, and quickly he agreed. Buddy, Fred, the professor, Lewis, and Alice discussed the situation, identified what needed to be done, and agreed upon what role each of them would play. Such quick agreement was not necessarily a sign of panic, but close to it. Even as they met, No-No was everywhere.
"The gods are very mad," he told crowd after crowd. "They will send a gigantic killer whale to eat all our fish. Its enormous mouth will bite our iceberg into pieces and crush our children in its awful jaws. It will create 500-foot waves. We must stop this nonsense about nomads immediately."
Lewis pulled No-No aside and told him, truthfully, that weather forecasting would be more important in the future and that they needed to add more science to their approach. No-No listened warily.
"Therefore," Lewis said, "I have asked the professor to help us."
No-No angrily turned around to leave and found the professor was already beside him.
"Did you read the article by Himmlisch on iceberg trauma?" the professor asked. "I believe it was published in the late 1960s.
No-No ran. The professor followed. And everywhere that No-No went,
Himmlisch was from Harvard, or rather he spent his later years there. Early in his career, "Leave me alone!"
In a very direct way, Lewis also dealt with those lobbying to be president of the Scouts. It was a short, very firm discussion.
"Enough," he told them.
Buddy's major role in the plan was to talk to the kindergarten teacher. The misty-eyed bird shared her fears with the penguin everyone liked, fears that clearly had been influencing her choice of the stories she was reading to the children.
"With all the change," she told him, nearly sobbing, "the colony may not need a kindergarten. It It may not need a teacher who is a bit too old to adapt.
She was very upset. Buddy was very sympathetic. When she stopped speaking, he told her,
No, the little birds will need to learn even more in a world that will be ever-changing. A kindergarten will be more important.
Her sobbing slowed. Buddy continued to speak of the essential role of schooling after all the changes.
I am very confident, he concluded with complete sincerity, that you can help them learn what is needed. You are a wonderful teacher. If you need to make adjustments here and there, I know you'll do it because you care so much for the little penguins.
He was reassuring. He was patient. He calmly and sincerely repeated his message again and again. She felt so relieved and happy that she wanted to kiss him. It was a truly touching scene. The actions by Lewis, the professor, and Buddy, with still others by Fred and Alice, all had an immediate effect. No-No created no new mischief, though he certainly wanted to. No matter where he went, the professor was right beside him, talking and talking and talking.
A regression of 6 variables has shown...
If you don't stop following me,
No-No screamed,
I'm going to...
Yes, yes. Now pay particular attention to this point. The regression...
After her chat with Buddy, the kindergarten teacher gathered her young students together to tell them tales of heroic action to help others under difficult and changing circumstances. She found some great stories. She told them with enthusiasm. She explained that the colony would be needing heroes to deal with new challenges, and that anyone, including the youngest of them, could help. The students loved it. That same evening, most of the nightmares stopped. The number of penguins actively working in the core group had dropped from 35 to 18. But now, as obstacles to change were being removed, as fewer and fewer of the more enthusiastic birds were feeling frustrated, distracted, or powerless, the numbers began to rise again. Lewis calculated that they would need around 50 birds to do all the work that had to be completed quickly. He didn't have 50 yet, but at least the trend was in the right direction. Sally Ann was just a kindergarten student. Her mind was filled with all the new stories of heroic action. While waddling home from school, she saw Alice. As youngsters do when they don't know any better, she approached this important bird and said,
Excuse me, how can I become a hero?
Alice stopped and looked at her. Preoccupied with the melting, the general mood of the colony, and the feeding the scouts problem, she barely heard the question. The youngster repeated it. Instead of saying, Just go home to your mother, Alice told her,
If you could make your parents understand that the head penguin needs their help, especially in catching fish to feed the scouts, then you would be a true hero.
That's all?
The little one replied, with all the hopeful naivete of the young. The next day, the child talked to her friends, and she had many friends. And from those discussions, an idea was born of how the children could help the colony make a nomadic life a reality. The kindergarten teacher canceled a few regular classes, broke a few rules, and helped give the idea some structure. It came to be called Tribute to Our Heroes Day. Some parents were nervous about all this activity. Making everyone, even the children, feel empowered was unprecedented in the colony. But the chicks loved it.
But what about your nightmares?
Oh, they're gone. Now I'm going to help the colony. She said we could all help, Dad.
the Scouts. Lewis decided they would need evidence, and quickly, that their efforts were on the right track. So his next step was to ask Fred to select a small, elite group of athletic and highly motivated scouts, coordinate their schedules, and send them off to search for potential new homes.
"The colony needs to see progress as soon as possible," the head penguin told Fred. "And we must do everything conceivable to help the scouts devise the means to protect themselves. We need every one of those birds to return safely and as fast as possible. Even one missing bird will create more anxiety and make No-No's warnings more credible. Remember, they don't need to pick a new home. Just find us a few possibilities."
The scouts were organized and left the next day. Fred had chosen well. They were strong, bright, and highly enthusiastic.
"Life was boring. This is fun.
I must help.
Jane will be proud of me."
The toughest single challenge facing the colony was gathering enough fresh fish to feed the tired and hungry scouts when they returned to their home. They would need a huge meal of fish immediately, up to 20 pounds worth, which, incredibly, a penguin can easily eat at one sitting. But there was that very old tradition in the colony in which birds, one, shared their food with their children, two, shared their food only with their children. So who would catch fish for the scouts? Into the void of practical solutions came little Sally Ann, the kindergartner, with her Tribute to Our Heroes Day idea. The Heroes Day celebration would include a raffle, performances, a band, and a flea market. The unusual price of admission? 2 fish per adult. The young birds explained the festive day to their parents. As you might imagine, some preoccupied adults could not quite grasp what they were hearing. Some did not like the idea much at all, and some were not even aware that scouts had left the iceberg. Yet many were proud of their children for being creative in a time of need. Still, parents felt a bit awkward. "You don't share food except with your children," was a very, very old and established tradition. So the inspired youngsters made it clear that they would be extremely embarrassed unless, one, their parents came to Heroes Day, and, two, each mother and father brought 2 fish as the cost of admission. As soon as a few parents relented, announcing that they would be bringing fish, others decided they must also. Social pressure works as well in penguin colonies as in human colonies. Lewis scheduled Heroes Day to coincide with the time the scouts were scheduled to return. From early in the morning until late in the afternoon, the event was an astonishing success. The games, band, raffle, and other events were great fun for everyone. But the climax came at the end, as the birds waited for the scouts. No-No predicted half would never make it back. "Whale food," he told as many as would listen to him. "The fools will get lost." Some birds nodded their heads, so he kept saying it. No-No was relentless. He worked harder that day than he had in years. Some in the colony were nervous, quite apart from No-No's antics. Some were still skeptical about the claims being made, all of which made the end of the day even more dramatic. Every single scout returned, one after the other, although a few looked like they were at death's door, and one was seriously hurt. Alice was waiting with a well-organized crew to care for any injury, which they did. Almost as soon as the scouts arrived, they began to tell amazing tales about the sea, about swimming long distances, and about new icebergs they had seen. Everyone crowded around the birds. Because they were so hungry, the scouts quickly and happily ate the fish that the other penguins had brought to the fair. Even as they were stuffing themselves, you could see that most of Fred's volunteers were extremely excited about what they had done. When they were finished, Sally Ann and her little friends gave the scouts ribbons to go around their necks. Made by the children, the ribbons were all tied to glittering ice medals with the simple inscription, "Hero." The crowd cheered. The scouts beamed, or at least as much as a penguin can beam. Lewis called for the child who had put in motion the events leading to the festive day. In front of the colony, he said,
"And this is for our youngest hero."
He handed Sally Ann the broken bottle, which had become somewhat legendary since first shown to all the birds. The crowd applauded enthusiastically. The child cried small tears of joy. Her parents were puffed up with pride. Alice was as happy as she could remember being in years. Discussions went late into the night, well after the children had been put to bed. Many in the colony continued to be amazed at what the scouts told them, even when it was said a second or third time. Most of the birds who were skeptical of a nomadic life found themselves becoming less skeptical. Birds who were enthusiastic felt more enthusiastic. Again, under trying circumstances, the colony had taken a very important step forward. Fred and the scouts had succeeded in creating what one MBA-sounding bird called a short-term win. It was a big win. No-No was nowhere in sight. He seemed to have been magically replaced by scouts wearing ribbons attached to medals. The second wave. The next morning, Lewis called a meeting of the scouts. The professor was also invited.
"What did you learn?" the head penguin asked the birds. "What icebergs did you see that might be big enough, in good shape, able to protect our eggs during the winter, and close enough so that our children and elderly can safely travel there?"
The scouts discussed what they had found. The professor asked question after question after question to distinguish opinions from facts. His style did not make him popular with all the birds. He could not have cared less, but it was very effective. After the Heroes' Day, more birds volunteered to be among the second wave of scouts, even though their task of selecting a single iceberg might be very taxing. Lewis chose a team from among the volunteers and sent them off to explore promising possibilities discovered by the first wave of scouts. Many of the skeptics in the colony were now becoming much less skeptical. Some birds still had reservations, many of which were rational. A few of the penguins were just nervous by nature.
"But what about this and that? It's really difficult."
"Well, nobody said it would be easy."
Almost no one was paying any attention to No-No anymore. Alice was relentless in keeping up the momentum of the work. Some on the leadership council complained that they did not have time to deal with all the issues that were arising. Alice pointed out that half their traditional leadership council meetings were irrelevant. "Eliminate them," she said bluntly. Lewis did. At one point, even the head penguin suggested that the right step might be to slow down. But Alice wouldn't hear of it. "We are constantly at risk of losing our courage. Some birds are already suggesting we wait until next winter. Then, if we are still alive, they will say the danger was overstated and that any change is not needed." It was a good point. The second wave of scouts found an iceberg that looked suitable for a number of reasons. It was a safe home. No evidence of melting or water-filled caves. Equipped with a tall snow wall to protect them from the icy storms. Close to good fishing sites. Located on a route with enough small icebergs or ice plateaus along the way to give the youngest and oldest penguins some rest during the journey. The returning scouts were proud, excited, and very happy. The rest of the colony was proud, excited, and happy to see them. By this time, the chore of gathering fish for scouts was already beginning to seem like a part of the normal routine. Many birds helped. It was all rather astonishing. The professor was asked to assess more scientifically the newly found piece of ice and snow. He was not enthusiastic about this task. He was overweight, and the journey to the new iceberg was not a short one. But after a quiet chat with Lewis, and a not-so-quiet chat with Alice, he announced he was ready to accompany a group of scouts. And he did. Meanwhile, the colony was busy with other important, though pleasant, routines, like creating new little penguins.
Pete, did you miss our iceberg when you were away?
No, but I missed you, Jane.
Then, on May the 12th, just before the start of Antarctica's winter, the birds began their move to their new home. It was not a moment too soon. The move was chaotic at times. At one point, a few penguins were lost, and there was a panic. But those birds found their way back to the others, and for the most part, all went as well as one could hope. Because of his effective leadership, Lewis became greatly admired by the colony. Yet, to his credit, he did not allow his pride to slide into arrogance. Buddy soothed the worried, encouraged the downtrodden, calmed the frantic, and probably had another 10 female birds fall in love with him. But that's another story. When no one could think of a solution to a new problem, Fred was called in to display his level-headed creativity. The professor loved his new status in the colony. He even found, oddly, that he enjoyed the admiration of birds he thought had no brains at all. Alice seemed to exist on 3 hours of sleep a day. And No-No predicted doom until the very end. The winter passed. The colony had problems. Their new home was different. The best fishing grounds were in unfamiliar places. The winds bounced off walls of ice in unexpected ways. But the problems were not as large as the anxious birds had feared. The next season, the scouts found a still better iceberg, larger and with richer fishing grounds. And though it was tempting to declare that the colony had been subjected to enough change and should stay forever on their new home, they didn't. They moved again. It was a critical step. Not becoming complacent again and not letting up. As you might imagine, the preparation for the second move was less traumatic than the first.
Tomorrow we will move over there.
Why again? It's so nice here.
Who cares, as long as there are good fish in the area?
I love being a scout.
The most remarkable change. You might reasonably think our story is over, but it isn't quite. Some birds began to talk about how they had now found the perfect iceberg, and therefore, tradition dies a hard death. Culture changes with as much difficulty in penguin colonies as in human colonies. Alice convinced Lewis to shake up the leadership council. he was reluctant to do anything that would show disrespect for birds who had worked hard for years to help and serve the colony. Making the moves, while preserving the dignity of all, was not easy. But Alice was insistent, and when Alice was insistent, well, you know. A tough selection process was created for scouts. They were also given more fish, and their status within the colony went up even further. The Penguin school system added scouting as a new required subject in the curriculum. The professor took over as chief weather forecaster. A bit reluctant at first, he poured real science into the work and came to love the job. Fred was asked to serve on the leadership council as head of the scouts. He was honored and accepted. Buddy was offered a number of more important jobs. He turned them all down, but helped the leadership council find other good candidates. His lack of ambition came to be seen as great humility. The birds loved him even more. Today, the colony moves around like nomads. Most have accepted it. Some love it. Some never will. Lewis retired, became the grandfather figure for the whole colony, and enjoyed his free time more than he expected. A now slightly more balanced Alice took his place as head penguin. As time went on, the colony thrived.
It grew and grew. It became more skilled at handling new dangers, at least in part from what it had learned from the melting adventure. Grandfather Lewis became the colony's number one teacher. He was asked again and again by the younger birds to tell them the story of the great change. At first, he was reluctant, fearing that he would sound like an old-timer boasting about past successes, real or imagined. But eventually, he saw the importance of telling the chicks, in as interesting and fun a way as he could, about the specific steps the colony had taken. He talked about Fred's finding that the iceberg was melting, then how they, one, created a sense of urgency in the colony to deal with a difficult problem, two, put a carefully selected group in charge of guiding the change, three, found the sensible vision of a better future, four, communicated that vision so others would understand and accept it, 5. Removed as many obstacles to action as was practical. 6. Created some sort of success quickly. 7. Never let up until the new way of life was firmly established. And 8. Finally, ensured that the changes would not be overcome by stubborn, hard-to-die traditions. Although Lewis never said so explicitly in his telling of the story, he felt the most remarkable change of all was in how so many members of the colony had grown less afraid of change, were learning the specific steps needed to make any large adjustment to new circumstances, and worked well together to keep leaping into a better and better future. The former head penguin was particularly amazed at what even the youngsters were doing to help the colony. And for that, he loved them all the more.
The end of the story, not the audiobook. Changing and succeeding. Fables can be fun, but their power, as with the penguin story, lies in helping you act smarter,
producing more achievement, less confusion, lower stress, and a general sense of being in control through understanding what is going on around you.
Some people have minds that process our penguin tale automatically, finding clever methods used by the birds, thinking about their own personal experiences in light of those methods, and seeing their options for a better future. But anyone, including those people, can benefit from more conscious thought, discussion, and guidance. People from software engineers to executives, homemakers to pastors, high school students to retirees have consciously used the Penguin Story to better achieve what they want and what their organizations need. The process is one you can adapt to your own circumstances. First, listen to and reflect on the story. You might find it useful to listen to it more than once. You would be surprised how much is packed into our short tale. Ask yourself questions that are suggested directly by the story. Am I living on a melting iceberg or an iceberg that could melt? Melting icebergs come in dozens of forms. Product lines that are aging, schools that are becoming irrelevant, services that are decreasing in quality, a business strategy that makes increasingly little sense, a new strategy whose implementation is sinking into the ocean. Who are the no-nos around me? Who are the Alices and Freds? Who am I? This reflection can be aided greatly by knowledge of Cotter's research on successful change, a brief summary of which follows. You can examine, for each of the 8 steps, how our clever penguins achieved what they achieved. Then you can look, step by step, at what you and your organization have been doing or are planning to do. The 8-step process of successful change. Set the stage. 1. Create a sense of urgency. Help others see the need for change and the importance of acting immediately. 2. Pull together the guiding team. Make sure there is a powerful group guiding the change, one with leadership skills, credibility, communications ability, authority, analytical skills, and a sense of urgency. Decide what to do. 3. Develop the change vision and strategy. Clarify how the future will be different from the past and how you can make that future a reality. Make it happen. 4. Communicate for understanding and buy-in. Make sure as many others as possible understand and accept the vision and the strategy. 5. Empower others to act. Remove as many barriers as possible so that those who want to make the vision a reality can do so. 6. Produce short-term wins. Create some visible, unambiguous successes as soon as possible. 7. Don't let up. Press harder and faster after the first successes. Be relentless with initiating change after change until the vision is a reality. Make it stick. 8. Create a new culture. Hold on to the new ways of behaving and make sure they succeed until they become strong enough to replace old traditions. The role of thinking and feeling. Thinking differently can help change behavior and lead to better results. Collect data. Analyze it. Present the information logically to change people's thinking. Changed thinking, in turn, can change behavior. Feeling differently can change behavior more and lead to even better results. Create surprising, compelling, and, if possible, visual experiences. The experiences change how people feel about a situation. A change in feelings can lead to a significant change in behavior. If you are an analytical person, a formal analysis in 4 columns, the 8 steps, what the birds did, what you and your groups have been doing, what you might do, can be a powerful method of reflection. After listening and reflecting, you discuss the story with others who have also read or listened to the book. The discussions can be informal, in training programs, as a part of regular on-the-job meetings, or with friends and family. Penguin language, icebergs, Alice, hero medals, can both facilitate communication and make discussions of difficult topics less confusing and threatening. Experience has taught us that these sorts of discussions can be very helpful. You find other tools to help apply the lessons in the fable. For anyone who likes research-based business books, Leading Change and Heart of Change can be very useful. Today, we have high-tech tools. We will be posting stories about what people have actually done as a result of the Penguin Fable, methods for facilitating a dialogue among people who have read or listened to the book, and more structured training exercises at www.ouricebergismelting.com. With the tools, the discussions, the book, and the audiobook, you find new and better ways to act or find increased conviction to stay the course you are already on. You find ways to initiate change needed by an organization or group. You find ways to help with the initiatives of others. You apply the 8-step method. In any case, you achieve more, gain more pride, have more fun, suffer fewer of the seemingly endless problems that can be created by a changing world, make your organization more successful, and put everyone less at risk. Finally, and this can be the biggest payoff of the exercise, when you act in concert with others, because you have all read or listened to, reflected on, and discussed the same fable, the end results can be very powerful.
If we have learned one overwhelmingly important lesson in the past few years, it is this. When leadership council birds, the middle management penguins, and the chicks are all on the same page with regards to change, it is amazing what can happen, despite adverse conditions. You can use this approach outside the workplace, too. In community groups, sports teams, houses of worship, even in families. Once you start to think about it, you find there are melting icebergs, or icebergs vulnerable to melting, all over the place. Listening to others, we never cease to be amazed at how many iceberg problems exist in our rapidly changing world. We never cease to be amazed at how difficult those problems can be to see and solve. But most of all, we never cease to be amazed at the creative ways people invent to jump ahead and develop better futures for very small groups, for very large organizations, and for themselves personally. Humans can, sometimes, be even more clever than penguins. The end. Except for listeners wanting extra credit.
The Case for the Book. In 1996, John Cotter wrote Leading Change. It was named the number one management book of the year by Executive General and has subsequently become the number one best-selling book in the past decade on the subject of change within organizations. As much as we can tell, the framework in the book is used by more leaders more often than any other single methodology for dealing with large changes, no matter the form. Creating more growth, eliminating inefficiencies, improving the quality of products or services, or redoing who does what and how. Leading Change was based on extensive research that identified and defined the 8-step pattern associated with highly successful change efforts. Leading Change talks about each of the steps in some depth. 6 years later, Cotter wrote, with Dan Cohen, a follow-up book, The Heart of Change. It was also a bestseller and award winner. The Heart of Change was again based on extensive research that reconfirmed the findings from the original study and added an important new insight. People are less likely to change themselves and others based on data and analysis than on compelling experiences. Feelings often trump thinking. The Heart of Change explores this insight with more than 20 real stories from well-known businesses and various branches of the government. During this period, Cotter became absolutely convinced that the rate of change was only going to continue to go up. He also became convinced that 90% of organizations were either ignoring relevant changes or were trying to adjust in ways that were not meeting their aspirations. Too much time and money was being spent to achieve too little, with too much pain and frustration all around.
Cotter also concluded that dealing with change was becoming an increasingly important skill for people not only at the top of organizations, but up and down hierarchies. In the most successful change efforts Cotter researched, nearly everyone played crucial roles in helping enterprises adapt to a changing world. Yet in the vast majority of the organizations he studied, most people didn't know what to do, felt threatened, or were convinced top management didn't want their help. This inevitably led to wasted effort, poorer decisions, slower movement, and more frustration. Enter Rathgeber. He was inspired by Cotter's award-winning books to develop a short training exercise about a penguin colony. The cover of Leading Change has a picture of penguins. The exercise was designed for use by senior and junior personnel. Cotter began collaborating with Rathgeber on that project, then suggested they write a book. The resulting Penguins Fable drew on the frameworks in Leading Change and The Heart of Change, on additional lessons the authors have learned in the past few years about effective change, on a theory of learning through memorable stories and visual stimuli, like illustrations, and from current knowledge in neurology and related disciplines about how the human mind works. The end result does not look remotely like a typical professional book. It is a book that can seem, at first glance, either silly or dumbed down, but in fact is far from either. Our goal in writing Our Iceberg is Melting was to draw on the incredible power of good stories to influence behavior over time, making individuals and their groups more competent in handling change and producing better results. One of the beauties of a good story is that they can induce action from a broad range of people in a manner quite different from most traditional professional books. The authors strongly believe that the world needs much more action from a broader range of people, action that is informed, committed, and inspired to help us all in an era of increasing change. As of the time of this recording, we have run a dozen experiments with the book. Some have focused on individuals reading the manuscript, some on the use of the book in formal training, some on managers discussing the manuscript with their work groups, and some on simply giving books to large numbers of people in a company, a division of an organization, or a department. The goal of the latter has been to have a systems-wide effect, getting all the atoms vibrating on the same frequency, which rarely happens with a traditional business book that is read by a limited number of people. Thus far, all the experiments have shown promising results. When an early reader was asked what he thought the book accomplished, he wrote, "For someone who has overseen several deliberate change initiatives, the book puts a smile on your face. It makes you appreciate how the structure of the story logically lays out the change process along with typical obstacles. It forces you to remember how much common sense is involved and how predictable some of the process steps are, but that relationships, patience, and communication should never be underestimated, and that change is emotional. It shows you a low-threat tool that can be used to initiate discussion around the process for newly assembled project teams. The ability to refer back to a humorous account of a change process like this can diffuse some of the emotion experienced by teams that periodically get caught up in what they think only they are experiencing." It provides a tool to stimulate discussion around innovation throughout an organization. Inevitably, the life cycle brings you to stagnation and complacency. Why not throw an iceberg in front of a few folks every now and then? For someone who hasn't led or participated in a pragmatic change initiative, it puts a smile on your face because you can identify with one or several of the penguins right away. It gives you a quick but also comprehensive picture of a methodical and familiar change initiative in a digestible format. It helps you see yourself as one of the heroes and envision yourself as an eligible champion for change, because it allows you to decipher the mysteries of what you may have previously thought was territory reserved for only the bosses with all the answers. It shows that real progress requires the participation of a team, where everyone has an important role, including you, and everyone knows his role. And in all cases, those who have been through a major change effort, those who have not, those at the top of enterprises, and those who are not, the book helps create new and better skills and, most importantly, new and better results. That's not a bad summary of our intentions. The authors.
Hello, I'm John Cotter.
Hello, I'm Holger Rathgeber.
And we're the authors of Our Iceberg is Melting. The project that led up to this book, I suppose, depending how you're counting, goes back 5 or 15 years.
That long?
Yeah, well, you could argue longer. My work in the research that I've done at Harvard. I've been at Harvard Business School forever. And Holger, you've been basically...
I've worked in industry since the early 80s and collected the experiences that way.
Yes. In some of the work that I'd been doing, it kept leading increasingly to the topic of change, the fact that the world was changing faster and faster, and that most people in organizations were really challenged by that. They didn't know quite how to deal with those rates of change, which were increasingly demanding kind of leaps into the future. And that led initially to a book I wrote called Leading Change. And that, at least people said it was useful enough that we did a follow-up project and published a book called The Heart of Change. Now, when did you first come across these books? Do you remember?
Must have been in the early, mid-90s.
And then what immediately led to this project is that Holger took that material and started doing something with it. Now, what's the story there?
John, this is classic, you know. You get tipped on the shoulder, hey, we have a great conference coming up and we need to do something on change. Change management, as they call it, which is actually, in my view, an oxymoron. Doesn't work.
Right, right.
So, and I knew that the audience all had read your books. It was part of our management development program. So here I was sitting, having 3 hours with 100 people, knowing that running through PowerPoint for 3 hours wouldn't really work.
Correct.
And that situation created the idea of putting that material into something that people could better relate to, they could play with, they could relate with. And talking to people, suddenly there was the idea of why not put up a fable in which people would act, where a story is told and people would act within the story, become an animal in the fable by themselves. And from there to the penguins, was just a short way. I love penguins. Do you?
Absolutely. But where did you get the penguin idea?
I was searching for ideas. And as it often happens, when you search, you find. So I was running through a bookstore and suddenly saw this wonderful children book with penguin illustrations in it. And that's it. I love penguins. And that was the idea.
The same non-threatening idea I've heard again and again. I'm just thinking of one instant where somebody sent me an email a few months ago where they apparently had shared the story with a number of people, and the feedback was it allowed for some conversations that simply weren't happening before. It took hot issues that, if they were talked about, were talked about in muffled tones by water coolers, and got them on the table. The guy literally gave an example of a meeting where it was now possible for everybody to kind of at one point, you know, lean over to Harold there and say, well, Harold's kind of a no-no, ha, 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 ha. And everybody laughs because, of course, this is just a story that we can make. And nobody in the right mind before would have said, Harold, you're blocking the whole thing. You hate change. They're dragging the company down. I hate you. Again, difficult topics, less threatening, pulls people in, gets the ball moving. I think it's the same theme.
It's absolutely the same theme.
And just on that, I mentioned no-no. Another thing that I keep hearing in some of these messages that get back to me from people who are creatively using this stuff is the language. How simply not only no-no, but icebergs and squid hunts.
And bottles.
Yeah, and bottles. People pick that up and start using that as a new language system. Which I suppose does a number of things. One is, like any language system, it's efficient. You don't have to run on with four sentences. A bottle means something to everybody. And again, I think it's, isn't it? It's kind of a friendly language system.
Yeah, because it's not only friendly, it very much works much better than all these terms which we use today, which mean so many different things to so many different people.
Right.
And they sometimes even think that they agreed on something.
When they haven't.
When they haven't.
Yeah. And I know at least some of the people that I know, even some of my students, although they won't admit it in public, hate management speak. They do. They like more concrete things. So instead of some abstract notion, they like talking about shoes or, in our case, you know, icebergs. And there's something good about that. I'm not quite sure if I can articulate it very well.
I think you have. It makes it so much easier. It allows you to connect at a situation which is unambiguous. It tells everybody the same.
Right.
If you look for a bottle, that means you look for a way of demonstrating to people some truth, for example, that really hits them. And you cannot escape this truth, so the chances that you move forward in your change are huge.
Right. And again, around the taking really tough topics, I mean, the reality of, I mean, reengineering can be pretty awful. Let's face it. Even new strategies that have great long-term potential, all the disruption that they cause if you're trying to implement them can be at least frustrating, if not scary. Dumping in new IT systems, you know, you can, the list of big changes that people have to make or want to make is endless. One of the things that was sent to me recently was a case where a company very smartly is trying to get ahead of the curve, not end up in a bad position, but get out front of problems before they happen. But it's difficult, you know, threatening. They're the kind of things that make people worry, you know, is my job or whatever. And they created, very creatively again, a 20-minute video that included their own little version, a video version of the basic story in the book. And then the rest of it included the CEO talking about the challenges they're facing, some of the other middle managers, et cetera. And what impressed me, at least, is they were getting across, and they're going to show that to every single employee in the company. So 20,000 people are going to see this thing. And what impressed me is they are trying to get at difficult, sometimes hard to even understand as well as threatening issues. And they do. They go at it, but there's something about the story and their use of that language afterwards that, what, it makes it people a little more optimistic about the possibilities. It makes it, it takes the sharp edge off of it. I don't know. I'm not sure if I can even articulate it well, but I thought it was very creative. And what I've heard so far, you know, this is hardly over this case, is that they think it's being very helpful. You saw that video, right?
I saw it, and I found it was very a very creative way of,
right.
of connecting the two things. One of it was a clear need to drive change. I think the reasons offered were compelling, and although there was not a crisis, and, you know, crises are easy in one way, easy catching attention.
Right.
Most companies even have a crisis culture, meaning
right.
they perform highest when they have a fire.
Right.
But you cannot sustain it.
Yeah.
You not always have a crisis at hand. Sometimes you need to get ahead of the curve.
Right.
And
which was the case here, because this was a leader in its industry. So it wasn't as if there were fire burning all over the place.
And that's the worst starting position you can have.
Right.
Being the leader, not having a visible crisis, unless you really have a deep industry understanding of your own business and where it's going, and you need to have from 15 people to 20,000 people, 100,000 people, understand,
right.
get that picture,
right.
and shift up a gear, although you're already the leader. That's the toughest situation you can be in, almost.
Yeah. Too many people who are running organizations these days that I know, it's the equivalent that they're chained to the biggest near Cairo pyramids, and they're trying to drag them across the desert. And they, you know, they're working 14-hour days, and they're getting stressed out, and they need a lot more informed, smart help. And it's amazing how some of these guys figure this out very quickly, but some haven't been taught that. They've been taught in a different era where the big boys made all the big decisions and kind of did all the big work, but that was a different era.
No, it's this eternal, I think many people still, at least that's what I find in the world of work, they confuse power to make a decision with power to make it work.
Right.
Which is a lethal recipe, actually.
Right, right.
And, but by the way, back to that video, there was one thing which really kind of caught my attention is when they had that senior VP who already kind of looked like a buddy. I don't know how they managed that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He already looked like a buddy to me, and he was up there and said, I'm married since 35 years. I'm working for this company since 32 years. My last four cars have all been the same brand. Two different colors, though. I can honestly say I hate change.
It was beautifully done. The audience laughed.
The audience blasted and laughed. But when he said, but guys, it's needed.
Right.
We need change here.
Right.
You could almost sense something was going into the crowd.
Yep.
It was not this blah, blah, blah. There was a credible person relating to the crowd, which probably most of them also hate the change.
Yeah.
Talking to them in a way that they could relate. And I think that was so brilliant.
And you're right. It was, he had both some of the same personality feeling and the capacity to tell a story that our buddy.
Yeah.
Did. And it was clever. I hadn't even thought of that. And they kind of stuck him up front in that video. Yeah. So they got Buddy to help out with that overall presentation they were making. Very creative. I think one of the, just on the creative theme again, that early on when people started playing with this book, it was going to be used in a three-day meeting. And the original design was they would have, and I forget how many people were in the meeting. It wasn't small. It wasn't like five or six. It was more like 50 or 60. The original design was they'd have everybody at the evening of the first day, read the book because it's short enough that it's possible. Mm-hmm. And then they were going to spend 2 or 3 hours the next morning talking about it. And then they move on and they have speaker number two, speaker number three, which was most of the meeting. Speaker is talking about a very, very important change problem they were dealing with. And they turned it over to a guy to run the meeting. And he looked at the book. And he started just coming up with these wild ideas, basically all centered around not just using the book as something that you would talk about for a couple of hours, but as something that could help, what, integrate, facilitate the whole meeting. And
this is the guy who sent me that big hero medal?
That's the one. That's the one. He went running off. He made hero medals. Invented, what, ice chips for a little exercise. He showed up at dinner in a tuxedo with a penguin hat. He did it himself. And I think we've got that on our website. He runs off to Walmart or something like that to to buy something and put it together. Well, I would have never thought of that. But it was very clever, and at least the feedback that we've got when I debrief some people that have been in the meeting is that it was very effective, again, in taking a tough topic, making some sense out of it, helping people to get a better grasp on it, approaching a threatening topic in a less threatening way, giving them some language, et cetera, et cetera. But I love the creativity of that guy.
That was so cool. Well, working with groups, I continue to be amazed how much actually knowledge, understanding, deep understanding of what's going on and what needs to be done from a change perspective is already within the room.
Right.
So it's all there.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just needs to be grabbed.
Right.
And put into some flow.
Right.
And here you have a plan which has a chance to succeed.
Right.
Which is owned by the group.
Right.
Where you have energy and then you move. And that's always the thing.
Yeah. What I've seen from the beginning is if you can show people or give people a story of what works, more often than not, they find that you look at the audience and they're nodding their heads. So it's not as if it seems it's intuitively not obvious to them. And the problems, they nod their heads very quickly. When you say, companies run into problems where they allow too much complacency, or they put together the wrong teams to drive things, or there's no vision, or they communicate too little. You know, there's that list of common problems. It's amazing how much people latch onto that immediately. You know, they're out there, oh my God, I've seen that, 17 times. If you show them then the opposite side of what works, they can think up ideas that take it into more detail into their situation, sometimes quickly and in very creative ways that goes beyond just the basic patterns we found from our work over the years. One of the things we want to do is we want to capture more stories of people who are doing things, and we're going to put them up on the website that's been created for us, which is www.ouriceburgismelting.com. Not a particularly creative name, given the name of the book. But, it's effective. And we want to put up stories of very creative ways that people have used the book so that we can share that with everybody. And we want to welcome anyone to write us just through the website, easy way to do it, about what they're doing. And hopefully we're going to create a very rich vehicle to share experiences across companies and industries.
Well, and that all in the spirit, actually, to help people be in the game, win the game called the ever-changing world, which is there. And I'm still thrilled by the idea that there's so much unnecessary pain, so much things that don't need to happen if people have an idea, a creative way of going through the next step. And it would be just thrilling to see that this platform, our website, becomes a forum of people openly sharing ways they found work to help other people get better results and change.
I agree. It'd be thrilling. And I have high hopes it'll happen. What do you think, Holger? Is it going to happen?
Absolutely.
I agree.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Our Iceberg is Melting, Changing and Succeeding Under Any Conditions by John Cotter and Holger Rathgeber. Produced and directed by Laura Wilson. Forward copyright by Spencer Johnson, M.D. Text copyright 2005 by John Cotter and Holger Rathgeber. Production copyright 2006, Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.